Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted now to be joined by Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello, Joe Devine.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm very well. I've overeaten, I'm tired, I feel full, lethargic, sluggish.
Sure.
But one more podcast.
It was a big day of football,
sure,
wasn't it,
was.
JJ Bull the Bullard?
Hey! Yeah, it was good. I really enjoyed it today. I had a great time watching all the football. And good goals. Good time had by all.
It really was. It was a really good time had by me and by everyone else that was here. We loved the game. Do you know what I loved about it most?
The goals.
It was the jeopardy. Apparently, according to the TV commentary, Portugal's position was every one of 1-4 in that group during the game state there this evening. Oh, you can't ask for more stakes than that. Unless you're at an Outback Steakhouse, I think you can ask for as many as you want. They've got a kitchen full, haven't they? But other than that, outside of the steakhouse, it's the Euros. You know where else you can get loads of good stuff in a row? It's The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFOFootball, I guarantee you will find some of the best writing about football and indeed other sports on the internet from writers such as Rafa Honigsteiner, James McNicholas, James Horncastle, David Ornstein. The list is almost never-ending of fantastic writers. And you can get a 30-day free trial if you try The Athletic out now by visiting theathletic.com/TIFO. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. But enough of this. Now we're going to get into the meat of today's episode. We're going to be talking about France, Portugal, Germany, Hungary, Spain, Sweden, Poland, and Slovakia. And also what happens next in the round of 16, because we now know who's going to face who in the knockout stages. And that's very exciting because there are a couple of top class clashes. So we'll come to that a little bit later on. But for now, I will say I'll leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Seb Stafford-Blore and JJ Bull the Bullard. Okay, let us begin today's episode with discussion. We will come to Germany, which was in some cases the more interesting part of the day. But we're going to talk first about France versus Portugal. It was France 2-2 Portugal. And the first thing I wanted to say, JJ, interesting game to watch. Most interesting thing for me was from the beginning because both teams tweaked their setups pretty rigidly in some cases. Lots in the midfield. Portugal had a 2 in previous games, moved to a 3. France had a 3, went the opposite way. Rabiot out for Tolisso, we'll come to that. But let's start with Portugal dropping Bruno Fernandes because that felt like a very big decision, which actually, you have to say, paid off in the game.
Well, I think the reason they did that is because these two teams have played each other over the last however long, maybe a year or so. And they've been the one goal in the two games. It was a very scrappy N'Golo Kanté goal, a prolific N'Golo Kanté. I mean, you can't tell everything just from that, but you kind of can. It was very tight.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It's very tight, very equal in the games. And so I think they both expected a similar match pretty much because of where they were in the group, perhaps.
Yeah.
Either way.
Well, no one was expecting Hungary to be leading in Munich for most of the evening, right? So I think Portugal and France probably both felt that they were safe going into the game.
Probably. I don't think either of them didn't want to win or anything like that. Or they weren't just playing for a draw, but they want to be as safe as they can,
yeah.
Minimize risk. Now, one of the things you get with Bruno Fernandes, as good a player as he is, his pass completion rate, if we're going into that sort of stats, is not as high as certain other attacking midfielders because he tries a lot of things to make a lot of things happen. So he'll be quite low in games. He'll finish with 85%. And it looks like, well, that's not good enough. He should be at 90 because that's what you want to have and complete your passes. But it's because he's trying to force through balls. He's trying to force players into space. Really valuable for Manchester United especially and Portugal. But in this game, when you want to have control of the ball in the game because France are so dangerous in transition, you've got Mbappe, Griezmann, Benzema, Hernandez, Pogba, Kante, all of them are quick and can get up the pitch really quickly. So that's where they can hurt you. And that's what France would look to do against Portugal because of what they've played. They're going to play in transition. They know if they sit deep against them, Portugal can do the same thing to them. They've got Diogo Jota, Bernardo Silva, Ronaldo, all that kind of pace up top that can exploit a single mistake. So you bring in João Moutinho, who is fantastic in possession of the ball, and therefore you get greater control of the match. You don't lose the ball in silly areas because rather than force that through ball, he will wait the extra pass and look for the space before you get it in. Now, Renato Sanches comes in and I thought he was superb tonight.
Yeah, he had a great game.
Yeah. I mean, there's an article in The Athletic, actually, it was quite good about the rebuild of Sanches. Jack Lang wrote it, I think. So obviously you might remember him from like Swansea and places like that where it didn't really go well for him. And he's been at Bayern, I think, and it didn't really work out there either. What I've read about him is that he tends to have been really good in training, but can't really move that onto the pitch. But I have seen him, his best games I've seen for him have been playing for Portugal. Wonder why that is. He comes in, gives you energy across the midfield. Next to Moutinho, who's a little bit older now, so not as mobile. He can still run. He's not like a fridge in the middle of the pitch or anything like that.
Sure. He didn't come from the retirement home to play.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think he's younger than I.
Yeah.
But then you've got Sanchez with energy there. You've got Danilo just behind him, holding that six role. Maybe you don't need Carvalho there. So you can have Sanchez rather than him there. It's a 4-1, kind of 4-1. And you get to break when you can against France, who you know are going to be waiting to do the similar thing to you. And France's changes, they brought in, Tolisso came in, and they kind of played this 4-4-2, out of possession, like a 4-4-2. And the two forwards were Benzema and Griezmann, and you could say it's a 4-4-2, you could say it's a 4-4-1-1 or a 4-2-3-1. The numbers don't matter, because it's all about blocking the space out of possession, squashing it between the lines. And then because Mbappe's playing wide left, him, Benzema and Griezmann can break, an attack is that kind of trident, but they'll move around a bit like how Leicester used to in a 4-4-2, but except it was Mahrez off the right. Then Tolisso can come in because he's a very hard-working, box-to-box kind of defensive midfielder. Not very used at Bayern, is he?
No, not really. But I mean, when I have seen him, I've seen him play centrally. So this is a slightly different role for him tonight. It's kind of, I was interested to see like the adjustment that he made. And it was, I don't know, it felt a little bit like he was a little bit more defensively orientated and they lacked a little bit of balance going forward. I don't know. Yeah. One of the things I want to talk about is, can you imagine how strange that was for Bruno Fernandes? Like if you're central to Manchester United, you're used to being the player that everything goes through. You're an automatic selection and you're the player that everyone talks about ahead of big games, any kind of game. If Bruno Fernandes plays well, United win. If they don't, they may not lose or even draw, but they tend to play worse and you get dropped. That's going to be really alien. That's going to be
We talked about this yesterday, didn't we? The idea that he is extremely central to United. The team is built around the way that he plays. And clearly that's not the case for Portugal for a number of reasons. One of the reasons being that they're playing international football and there seems to be a bit more of an emphasis on not negative, but slightly more conservative football. Ronaldo is obviously still the focal point of that team. And I think we've seen from the first two games, the worst thing about Portugal, particularly in the first game, was that midfield double pivot of Danilo and Carvalho. We saw in both games as Renato Sanches came on that completely changed the way that Portugal were able to progress the ball, partly because of how well he can carry it forwards and how, you know, he feels like a very press resistant player, right?
Yeah.
So I think the only way to get him in the team or the person so far in the tournament that's shown to make the greatest difference or have the biggest impact on Portugal, the only way to do that is drop Fernandes, right? So it's totally polar opposite.
Yeah, it's difficult. Also, like, it's worth remembering why he came to Manchester United in the first place. He was an answer to something. There was a kind of poverty of creativity and ideas and flair, and he was an answer to that. Like, over time, one of many. Portugal aren't lacking any of those qualities, really. Like, their midfield so far in this tournament has, because it's been a little bit of a conservative selection, and we've talked about that in a few podcasts. But if you look at the sort of the attacking players available, that doesn't lack sort of thrust or creativity.
Also, not every team needs a 10, right?
Exactly. And so the dependency on a player like Bruno Fernandes is different team to team. But I mean, it's a really difficult choice because I completely agree. Like, so to me, Sanchez has to play because without it, that midfield is very passive. He is a box-to-box player and he's, as you said, Joe, press resistant. He also seems to, I'd love to see the statistics actually, but he seems to be more active in the press itself and exert more pressure on the players on the defensive line and the team as they work, his opponent, as they work the ball out of defence. And that seems to be something that Portugal really lacked, especially against Germany. Portugal had a lot of other problems against Germany, but one of them was that they were very passive. They didn't stop Germany doing anything that they wanted to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Sanchez is not a one-man solution to that problem because Michael Cox wrote a fantastic article about this on The Athletic, another plug. But it feels like a better solution.
You don't need to describe the plug as a plug.
I feel like I want to make sure that, you know, people know, oh, that's a plug. Oh, maybe, you know, I didn't sell it.
When you get on the bus, do you point at it and go, this is a bus when you're on?
No, it's more like I am on the bus.
Sure.
And then sit down and then.
He loves to narrate himself.
Yeah.
Loves the bus.
I like Renato Sanchez. We've talked about this a lot. We talked about it before the tournament, and it just feels healthier. Like there feels like less of a gap between Portugal's attacking parts and the rest of the team when he's on the pitch. I think that's the best way to put it. A connecting piece, should we say.
Okay, well, talking about connecting pieces, someone who is often considered to be a connecting piece in both his club career and his international career, Karim Benzema, star of the show in some ways today for France. I mean, you know, had a good performance, right?
Yeah, I mean, star of the show, maybe the referee a little bit.
Okay, tell me more.
Mathieu Lahoss has a reputation, and it is as a kind of Spanish Mike Dean, and I think we saw why tonight. We had a big old discussion in the office about the first penalty when Lloris kind of inadvertently punched Danilo in the face.
Mm-hmm. That was bad.
I can understand both sides of that discussion. You think it's a penalty. I don't, on the basis that I've seen that happen so many times and a penalty not awarded. So I purely on precedent, I don't think it is. However, the second one, what is the value of VAR if it's not to say, if it's not to kind of clip a referee's wings sometimes when he's making a decision which is to even up the game, or it's just not a penalty. It's an opportunity to give one. That's not the same thing as actually being a penalty, and it annoys me. And we talked about this a couple of nights ago, about referees who quite like the big occasion, quite like the big decision during the big occasion. And he does this. Like, if you followed his career, he's a man for those moments. And it
a direct
me.
Attack, shots fired.
I just think it's quite annoying. It's like, because when we got to the end of the first half, it was sort of, well, that was the referee, you know, in the kind of the headlining spot with the warm-up acts as two of the best nations in European football. It's just, don't do it.
JJ Bull, pour some water on this fire.
Water on the fire. When Danilo got punched in the face, I mean, that's clearly a penalty, though.
But how many times we've seen it? And I agree with you.
I don't know if I've ever seen that before, by the way. Like, I mean, the way that he got hit in the face. Yeah. I can't remember a time. I know people joke in the comments that I feel like I've not seen anything ever happen in football, but I don't remember a time where a goalkeeper has actually full-on, accidentally, of course, punched a player in the face.
I feel like it's one of the...
clipping. I've seen clipping.
It's one of the costs of that situation. It's something that can happen and you never want to see it happen and you want everyone to be okay. Of course you do. It's just that when a goalkeeper's making a punch and he gets a bit of the ball and a bit of the player, it seems more often than not that the goalkeeper gets the benefit of the doubt. It just gets sort of dismissed as a footballing incident.
Yeah, but I think we had this conversation earlier and my retort was that when a player goes in for a tackle and gets a bit of the ball and then like kicks someone in the face by accident, that's a foul.
I understand.
I mean, like you described it earlier as a sort of one of the risks of that sort of challenge. Like, yeah.
Well, on that note, I mean, something I think is interesting. Right? If you take like a bicycle kick or a scissor kick in the area, you know there's someone right behind you, and you go for a bicycle kick, you know you're going to probably smash them in the face unless they pull out of it. And the ones where the ball is struck correctly and goes in the goal, often the defender has pulled out of the header because they know they're going to get their head caved in if they go for it. So you think, is that not dangerous play? It would be one of the best goals you ever see, but...
It completely is dangerous play. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be a penalty. It should. It's just that it doesn't often get given.
Yeah.
It's like shirt pulling in the area. It's one of those things that everyone sees and it just feels a little bit like it's a kind of an unwritten rule that we don't give those.
And King in the Indies in the chat says you shouldn't be allowed to punch people in the face.
Yeah.
Very true.
I feel like that's more violent than pulling a shirt.
Football has allowed that in that situation. It's unfortunate, but that's what's happened. That's what's been allowed to be the precedent because referees have ducked that kind of decision. And it's just...
I think there's a confusion here on what constitutes a clear punch in the face, because like clipping, sure, players sort of accidentally getting in the way at the end of a goalkeeper's punch, yes, okay. This is inadvertent, of course. He leathered him in the face. I mean, I'm not sure I've seen that. I don't know if there is precedent. When's there been precedent for a goalkeeper full on punching someone in the face and not being a penalty?
Well, when a goalkeeper comes to make a punch, like, there's typically contact in that area. If the ball's
he's low enough to get...
Sure, but like if you think about the Higuain-Neuer incident in the 2014 World Cup final, when he comes over the back of him, makes his punch, and he doesn't make contact with his fist, but he makes contact with his head, with his knee. And again, that's one of those things which is, yeah, it was awful. It was a terrible, it could have been incredibly serious, could have really badly hurt Gonzalo Higuain. But that was one of the situations where the referee was like, oh, that just kind of happens and that's what a goalkeeper does. And so we can't, it's like,
it sure, feels- but he wasn't, like, the difference here is that Lloris was punching at someone's head height. Like, that normally, yeah, what happens when a ball comes in and a goalkeeper punches it away is when it's over the head and they don't think they're going to catch it. He's stretching out forwards, punching where somebody's head is.
Yeah.
That, like, yep. No, I think the rule for that should be that a goalkeeper shouldn't be allowed to punch a ball out if a player could get their head that high.
But that's really difficult to police, though.
Well, I mean, not in this situation, because what happened was he accidentally punched him in the face, and then there was a penalty. It sounds like it's really easy to police.
But then if you're saying, like, a goalkeeper,
it's been policed.
Can't,
there was a penalty.
But if the situation JJ described earlier, where there's a bicycle kick in the box, and a defender pulls out of the challenge because he doesn't want to get his head caved in. Mm. Do you have a situation there where a goalkeeper comes to make a clear punch, and it's only a clear punch because the attacking players thought, oh, I don't fancy that, I'm just going to stop back? Because you have to sort of, you bring things like intent and what a player might do if the goalkeeper wasn't in that situation. It becomes very vague very quickly. And so it probably
I just think any way
really
to avoid
to
someone punching someone in the face by accident.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I just, it feels unusual. That's how I felt when I saw it.
I think that's why there's very little precedent.
I don't know. It feels like it happens more than we think.
We'll move on now, but you're with me, right? You're with me, yeah? I think Seb's lost it.
Seb might have done.
He got punched in the face. Anyway, we can argue about penalty decisions all day. That's a very TIFO thing for us to do. But let's move on to discuss the games that are coming up. I mean, we've got a lot to get through today, so we'll probably move on quite quickly. The very exciting one, JJ, Portugal, Belgium.
Oh, it'll be lovely.
That will be lovely, won't it?
Yeah, I thought so. Portugal are the team, I think, before the tournament, before I saw Italy play properly, that I thought Portugal would be right there till the end. But yeah, Belgium's a very tough one. In terms of how they'll play, I think Portugal will go back to their traditional defensive ways against a good team. Yeah. That's what they do. So they have expanded a little bit in qualifying and other sorts of games. So they have more attacking players and they are better than they were in 2016. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Feels like a long time ago.
Like they're more talented than 2016, doesn't it?
No, I don't know. I think they've got better players now. They could definitely have a lot.
That's what I mean. They're more talented than they were in 2016.
Oh, yes.
It feels like they were kind of in... I don't remember anyone before that tournament started thinking, right, Portugal are going to win this, because it seemed like that was very much a Ronaldo and 10 others kind of side.
It kind of affirmed a lot of the quality of some of those players, because you didn't think much of them. And so then you think, oh, wait, they can win a tournament.
Hey, Renato Sanchez. That's when we first kind of really paid attention to him. He was absolutely brilliant.
Ronaldo
tournament.
And Pepe.
Yeah, Pepe, that's very, very true. Yeah, and Patricio, I think.
Yeah, they had decent players. Yeah. And so they do open up and they are more attacking at times under Santos, because they have the ability to do it with the players they have, but they do it against weaker teams. And when you're playing against someone like Belgium, who's obviously one of the favourites and have good players too, you'll want to play in a certain way. But then we've seen from Belgium, they play a high line and their defenders aren't particularly quick. There are ways to get at them and get in behind them. They will have lots of the ball, but Portugal won't mind that. I think Diogo Jota, like, even looking at the way France lined up with putting Tolisso at that right midfield bit, I wonder if that's specifically to help the right back behind him, whose names escape me straight away. But because Jota plays... He plays on the... Jota plays on the left, so you have to deal with that threat. Jota's probably not underrated. He's probably somewhere about rated, but still slightly underrated. What am I talking
just
about?
Rated.
He's
rated.
He's magic. Like, he's such a good player and makes things happen. I think he's got
a little bit of a nothing game.
What, today?
Yeah.
But then they're specifically putting players on him to try and mark him out of the game, keep him quiet. Yeah. And then he may be tired because he's played two games in a row, and the third he's got not got much energy, and he's all about being able to buzz around in
the
space.
I love his movement, Jota. Like, the way he moves when... Like, when there's kind of there's a breakdown in the phase, the way he moves and the urgency in his football, it's just a fun player to watch. Mm-hmm. It's just enjoyable, makes games exciting. But it's like it felt tonight as if France came with a plan to nullify him specifically.
Yeah,
which was interesting.
And then Belgium, I mean, De Bruyne and Lukaku are playing very well just now for them. I'm not sure if they're on fire just at the moment, but they. they've been playing with that same group of players for a long time with the same manager, and that really helps, I think, knowing your like your system inside out and how you can adapt. I don't think Martinez would change anything from his normal 3-4-3 shape for this.
And they'll score. That's Belgium. The thing, right? Like Belgium will score, and so Portugal needs to score.
I don't know if they will. Like
I can't. I honestly, like watching De Bruyne and Lukaku in the last game, I don't see them not scoring against any team in the tournament.
I think you just squish the space and just don't let them do anything, and then
it's De Bruyne.
I know, but even the best players struggle against teams who sit deep, and then you've got players like Ronaldo and Jota going forward to the other end.
I'll look forward to your 0-0 prediction ahead of that one.
Yeah,
that'll be fun. Let's also say France are playing Switzerland, Seb.
Yeah, can't see them not winning that. Just because I think France dominating every area of the pitch there, midfield especially. Mm-hmm. I don't fancy Granit Xhaka against Pogba, Kante, and probably Rabiot. I think France have the edge there. Also, they're just stronger in every area of the pitch.
Sure.
I mean, we don't have to overcomplicate that. But yeah, France will love that draw.
Okay. Well, we will be back just after this.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
We're back, and we're going to discuss Germany 2, too hungry. Two goals conceded by Germany. Well, the first thing I suppose we should say is that this was a weird game, wasn't it? We had it on the second monitor and we were started to pay a lot more attention to it after about the 60-minute mark.
After we realised we hadn't paid any attention to
it. Yeah, after we realised we hadn't seen the first half, and somehow we saw the Germany equaliser and then Hungary's second goal just moments later. But for most of the evening, it looked as though Hungary were going to progress and Germany, surprisingly, after looking in some ways like the most exciting team in the group at times, we're going out. Of course, that hasn't happened. Germany go through second to face England in the next round, so we'll come on to talk about that shortly. But Seb, you've written here that the two goals that Germany conceded, very typical of their issues in recent times. That gives me hope as an England fan.
Yeah, well, it should do. If you look back at the kinds of goal Germany conceded over the last couple of years, there are some very familiar themes, and these repeated tonight. The first one was a really excellent header. Like you don't see that goal very often now, the really, you know, the strong thumping header, but probably shouldn't be getting between two markers there. And the second was, like, mentally it's an error because it comes right after the kickoff, after the equalizer, old cliche about that. But also there's just that element of chaos that you look at. And if you hadn't watched Germany since about, I don't know, 2016, you'd think, well, that's not very German, is it? That's very weird. That's kind of an England goal to concede. But this is the price of a lack of continuity. It's a lack of chemistry between those defensive parts. And it's a problem that Jürgen Löw has never cured. He's brought back Mats Hummels to make it slightly better. Mm. And he's moved Joshua Kimmich around to kind of compensate for what isn't there at fullback. But it's still not convincing.
Yeah.
You get at Germany. And what's been the difference in this tournament is they played really well going forward. Yeah. And their 3-4-3 worked like a dream against Portugal. But I felt like the more attention we paid to this, the more obvious it became that Hungary had really studied that Portugal game. I was looking at the touch map at full time.
Yeah.
And you can see that Germany never get into the positions. Obviously, the Portugal game was all about overlaps and spare men and getting to the byline and having really good crossing opportunities. And that didn't exist tonight. In fact, Germany very rarely got beyond the edge of the penalty box. And that was kind of, well done, Hungary. They stacked that area pretty well and blocked it up very, very nicely.
Sure. Okay.
That's one of the reasons I thought, I said it, I think, in the group of death preview, that Hungary would be able to do some damage to Germany. And I based that on having watched Germany playing against North Macedonia when they lost 2-1. Same system, 5-3-2. I mean, I know other teams are all sort of different, they do it in different ways. It's exactly the same, 5-3-2.
Sure.
You block the back, you squeeze the space, you get everyone back, and then you try and hit them in transition, and they did, and they managed to get those wins. Germany, like Seb was saying, they're vulnerable to certain types of goals, but you can see in their team like there's no power or like aggression in it. You need more, just more about them. When they put Goretzka on for Gundogan,
yeah,
straight away, it's not just because he's tall and strong, he just is quite busy.
Goretzka,
he's getting amongst it.
He's also... Mm-hmm. Goretzka's clever. Like, you notice him for his size and because of like how imposing he is in a midfield. But if you look at his goals and you look at the chances that he has, it's typically because of movement. So the German equaliser, it's not really a move that's come off. It's a lucky series of bounces. It takes about three deflections, which take four Hungarian defenders out of the game. And there, like, reliably is Goretzka in the perfect position to steer at home. And that
the prize for sustained pressure, right?
Just being able to anticipate what's happening. Absolutely, like, your reward for making an opponent crack a little bit and a little bit of good fortune. But there's nothing fortunate about Goretzka being there because he does that a lot and he finishes really well when he's in that position. And you can kind of, with him, you fall into the trap sometimes of thinking he's like, he's a unit, isn't he? He's a vending machine. He's a clogger. Really good footballer.
He's a clogger.
Yeah, but that's kind of, you see him and like you see the size of his upper body and that stuff and you can miss his technique and just how good a finisher he can be sometimes. So, and that was kind of what got Germany out of jail tonight. Obviously.
And then up top of Germany, you've got Sané and Gnabry who need space in behind to be useful. Yeah. There's none of that against this team.
Sané.
Bit of a chance for him to show his worth this evening, right, Sané?
Yeah, it's a funny. There's a bit of negativity around him in Germany. Like he didn't have the best first season with Bayern Munich. Obviously cost a lot of money. And I think one of the problems with him is he is so obviously so very talented. And there's, you know, quite often, it's very similar to like JJ and I were talking about Kingsley Coman during the game. It's quite similar because you see what he could be. And actually, because we saw him so much in the Premier League, we've seen what he can be. He's brilliant. Leroy Sané is a fantastic player. Just hasn't quite done it for Bayern Munich, hasn't quite done it for Germany either yet. And
I feel like he's the sort of player that would really benefit from being at a different team, right?
Maybe. I don't know. I think Bayern is a good stage for him. I can see him doing well. It's just that he doesn't, with him, he doesn't always make the right decisions when he gets up to the edge of the penalty box. There's something about Bayern's system which doesn't quite work for him in the way that it did at his best at Man City. I'm not smart enough to know what that is.
It's just, Sané. I was talking about the other player.
Goretzka?
Yeah. No. Coman. I was talking about Kingsley Coman being a different team.
Yeah, I think so. I think he's one of those players that sort of, he needs a stable position. He also needs to be somewhere where a manager just thinks, you are in my starting 11 every single week. I think that benefits him.
Whether he would get at Everton.
I think probably higher. Like I think you could put him at somewhere like Arsenal. I think he'd do very well.
Yeah.
I know Everton finished, but like it's a, I don't know. I think there's a really good player there. Like I always go back to, do you remember that game in the Champions League between Bayern and Juventus when Juve went 2-0 and Cuadrado scored that lovely goal on the counter when he kind of side-footed it into the top corner and Bayern came back to win it and it was all about Coman. Came on, I think, after about an hour. He was unplayable. I know it's a horrible little word, but he was just great. Absolutely fantastic. One of those kind of old-fashioned moments where anytime he got the ball, everyone was excited and you could sense something was going to happen. And I think maybe I've kind of grown a bias as a result of that game because I've always thought that that is the true Kingsley Coman. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. But it was, his career just feels quite disappointing.
Well, this Germany team are going to play England in the round of 16. That feels like an instant classic. I hope so. I know that you will be entirely unbiased when you tell me what you think about that game, JJ. So please go ahead.
Well, one of the things Germany are going to have to do to beat England is pass the ball quicker than they did against Hungary today. So I think one of the things that when I looked at Germany before this tournament is that they were too slow, their tempo was too slow. They can control games against good teams, I think. So they control the game against England, but they struggle to break down teams who sit deep, which might be what England do. So it's kind of hard to work out what's going to go on here. I think Germany will be, how do we say this? Like not smarter than England, but maybe a bit more cunning. And I think if they're playing a 3-4-3, you'd think Southgate would want to try and match that up so you can just have man for man across the pitch, just try and I can't see how that 4-2-3-1 will really work against them. The weaknesses are going to be that they're not very fast in behind a high defensive line, so again your players like Sterling and the other fast lads that England have.
Plenty of them.
Yeah, Foden. Yeah, I love Foden. All those boys can get in behind quite easily. I think Germany win the midfield battle easily out of what England have. Whether in a 2 or 3, I think Kroos and Gundogan just have that nailed down. So then you want to try and play around them and in transition. And you play wide and then whoever's left's got to deal with Kimmich if he plays in that right can look after that. I think Germany will be able to fall back. I think Germany will be really good in that game, maybe. I don't know what I'm talking about. I've run myself into a little
small hole. I think the idea of matching them up is really interesting. So, I mean, we've talked about that a lot before. JJ's mentioned it a couple of times. Alex has mentioned it in the past as a sensible thing to do against a team that are playing the way that Germany are playing. Do you think it'll happen? Because it didn't against Scotland.
Yeah, well, that's why, yeah.
I don't know. I would have thought Southgate will aim his midfield towards stopping Toni Kroos, which feels like one of those conservative decisions again. We're still unsure as to whether Mason Mount is going to be able to play.
I think unless I'm
I think he's allowed to play, something, but whether he's ready to play.
Unless I'm repeating something that I've heard that's inaccurate, his isolation ends the day before
Monday,
the next game.
So he would, if he's been doing enough training, he'll play. I think he'll play because I think Southgate will use him to pressure Kroos all the way through the game.
But see, they do that. What Germany will do, and they do this a lot, I mean, you'll know this, is that Kroos will just drop into one of the centre-back positions as they move up or into the wing-back sort of role. He just drops into wherever the space is. A bit like how Modric did against Scotland in that game, just is always able to find space. And then if England are trying to push that way, they have to have a high line to be able to push up as a unit, which then leaves space in behind. For the fast lads, you've got Sané, Gnabry. Well, I don't think Sané will play, but Gnabry, Werner maybe might come in. What a way for Werner to earn himself some redemption by getting in behind the England line and scoring the winner.
Yeah, it feels like Luis Suarez in 2014, something like that. This is my worry, that England pick a team that never really explores Germany's weaknesses, because you're not playing Germany as in world-class and the number one ranked side. You're facing a side that's very much in a state of transition, that's weak, that's vulnerable, that doesn't have a lot of confidence. So if it's me, I'd like to see something as aggressive as last night, which is that.
I think they'll thrash him.
I think they'll
win.
You reckon? I think it's got. If Southgate approaches it the way he has done,
be bold.
Yeah. If he's not bold and he sort of tries to be tactically clever and do what the safe, not in safe sounds so negative, like just the sensible tactician's way of playing, like get rid of the opponent's strengths, play to your own strengths. It'll end up being a draw and they go out in penalties. But that's probably what is, I mean, based on what always happens to England, I'm not just saying this because I'm trying to wind you up or anything.
No, but like, I don't know. I think that specific bit of analysis, JJ Bull the Bullard, is outdated after 2018. England are really good at penalties now. If they went to penalties, I'd be confident that they would win. I don't know that that's
for the base of one tournament.
Yeah.
Really,
on the basis of the way that they took the penalties in the game against
Colombia,
on the basis of the number of incredible attacking players that they have in their team, I don't think it would even necessarily get to penalties. I have total confidence that England can score goals against this Germany team. I think they've defended pretty badly at times in this tournament. They've looked exciting and incisive going forwards, and that's why I think it will be a fun game. I'll say again for the third day in a row, England haven't conceded a goal yet. Germany struggled to score against Hungary this evening. I don't see any reason why an England fan can't be confident ahead of this game. I know it's Germany.
Confidence is fine. I just think there's Germany not to be underestimated. Germany
not
are,
underestimating them. I just mean estimating in the sense, them.
You're estimating.
Estimating them.
I just think also estimating.
I'm just trying to balance out JJ's negativity.
It makes me want to really, really win.
It's kind of if that German forward line gels together. Which is capable to some of the players that England will use to match up. So if Tyrone Mings plays in the centre of defence, that would worry me a little bit, just because he isn't the most mobile. I think Mings is a good player. It's just you'd want to have probably Maguire and Stones if Maguire can play again so quickly after recovering from injury. There is a lot of attacking power in that German side still.
Can I address the chat?
You can,
because there are two people here. One of whom has said. It's arrogant the way England fans talk about England. Someone else has said that English overconfidence. I think it's a complete misunderstanding of like the modern England fan character in many cases. Like England fans are dapp about their team. They always expect to lose. It's that what you're saying is the complete opposite of how almost everyone I know expects to happen ahead of an England game. Confidence is something you don't find this very often. And as I said, I'm doing it to balance out what he said over there before. But because there was some negativity there.
I think the world's reaction isn't really based on like individual fans. It's based on things like the front page, the Sun ran when discussing the Scotland team, when it was sort of making fun of like the players they'd never heard of. And it just, that's the kind of public face of England fans. It's not fair.
Public face, but it's not reflective at all of like the vast majority of England fans. That's not how I
feel, it's not how you feel.
Everyone I know who supports England at a tournament like this,
very fatalistic, actually.
Most people just expect to lose every game. And then when we do lose a game, it's all, oh, we knew that was going to happen. And everyone's upset. You go to any pub around here. And what happens is you meet loads of other people who everyone says to each other, we're going to lose that one, aren't we?
I know
we're
going to lose that one. They're going to win 5-0. He's going to smash Germany. You said that.
This is why I'm saying, this is why I'm trying to be confident about it.
I haven't seen these people before.
To change the way I feel. Everybody I spoke to ahead of the Croatia game, including myself, we said, oh, we're going to lose that game, aren't we? This is, you know, like it's Croatia. They're a big team. And everyone I knew thought we were going to lose that game. And when we won that game, I made a little promise to myself to be confident about it and be positive about it and think when we play a team like Germany, we can win the game. We can win the game. I'm not trying to be overconfident. I'm joking and you know, being a bit of a jester about it. But I do think there's certainly an opportunity to win the game. It's far from a foregone conclusion, you would agree.
Yeah, as England are a good team and they have great players. And I like the players because I talk about them all of the time and watch them on the TV. So I hope the lads do well. I'm all for it. My mum and dad are English.
I think there's always
pointing that at you, by the way.
I think Joe's right in the sense that most England fans are really fatalistic. That's how I feel. Like I see embarrassment, humiliation around every corner against every opponent. We got to about 60 minutes in the Scotland game and I thought I'll take the goal as draw because that's better. And that's how I've been trained to think as a football fan.
Yeah.
There is this thing though whereby when Southgate came to the job and when people started not necessarily believing that the English national team was on the road to dominating world football again, but they started to like it again. They started to kind of move away from that, oh my God, golden generation
it's
again.
It's an amazing feeling.
It's a fun feeling to actually...
In comparison to what it was.
It was so bad and so disenfranchising that I think what happened is people got overexcited, but people are entitled to because it's a national team and they like a lot of the players. Again. Joe learned to love again. And I think it becomes a sort of... I think there's a little bit of willful denial where people go, oh, that's just English arrogance. I think there is a lot of English arrogance. I think people in the country are kind of predisposed to being quite obnoxious sometimes. Mm. But I think generally people just, they like the football and they like being invested and they like the players and there are a lot of likable characters on that side. And I think that spills over and I think, you know,
saying England are going to thrash Germany is obviously a stupid thing that only a stupid man would say. And that's me, right? But what I'm doing is I'm putting my heart out there and I'm saying, break it, it's fine. I'm willing to have it broken, that's all. And speaking of breaks, we're gonna go for one now and then we'll be back after that. We're back and we're gonna talk about Slovakia and Spain. Well, we're not gonna talk about Slovakia, really, but we're gonna talk about Spain because they scored 5 goals, JJ.
Yeah, and the first one was one of my favorite goals of the tournament. Poor Martin Dubravka punching into zone net.
Oh, man, that was hard.
Poor boy. So, I mean, one side, I feel sorry for him. Other side, it's really funny. And it looks like a computer game glitch going wrong. You're like, why is it punching into my own net? The game's against me.
We had to go closer to the TV after we saw it because we sort of both looked at each other and was like,
when it dropped, I sort of thought he was going to do it as well. Maybe I sort of Yuri Gellered him to do it. I'm sorry if I did. But I thought it's been a lot. So I think you said during the game, Joe, that it didn't seem like Spain because they scored like an own goal and a penalty or something like that.
I said that at 2-0 and I regretted that because afterwards they scored 3 really nice, really, really nice goals. But the point I was making was based on my experience of watching them so far in the tournament, what they've struggled to do is finish chances. And I feel like those final 3 goals of the 5 emphatically sort of blew that away. It's hard to say whether that is just within the sort of specific scenario of the game or whether that's Spain kind of firing on all cylinders now. What do you think?
Well, I thought they were excellent from the start because they played with the kind of tempo and aggression and energy that they lacked in other games. To play that kind of possession football, like we're talking about Germany, too slow. To me, 2-3 touches, they need to be 1 and 2. And Spain tonight were taking 1 and 2 touches, running at people, causing problems and then pressing immediately afterwards so Slovakia just couldn't get out. And that forces errors because you have to rush. And after you have a sustained period of pressure dealing with that, UFO stuff comes out soon. It's happening.
It already came out.
Did it?
Yeah. Oh. Craig said.
Yeah, okay. I'll read that later.
Yeah.
You were so excited as well. After sustained periods of pressure, you just want to get rid of the ball. Like, you want to try and play out from the back, and you end up just shelling it just to get out so you can reset. But because Spain are pushed so high, they keep coming at you, and that's when these sort of errors creep in. And then I think once you know, like, you're in real trouble with a third, you maybe just fall apart a little bit. And some of the goals were just so good. I think, who was the back heel flick? Was that Ferran Torres?
That was Ferran Torres. I think it was his first touch on the pitch.
And that's after replacing Morata, who offered not an awful lot again. But Torres, I really like Torres. I still can't quite figure out what his position is.
He's somewhere between a wide forward and a nine.
Yeah.
He's in that kind of gap that doesn't really have a proper definition.
It's like a really fast false nine, because you don't really get...
It's funny, because every time I've seen Spain between tournaments, it's the last tournament, last couple of years, when they do something good, he tends to be involved in it. Like in that 6-0 over Germany, it's absolutely fantastic.
He's got no... You know what it is? It's because he's got no, like, presence. He doesn't look like an amazing footballer. He's not... not used to buying him on FIFA or anything like that, or Football Manager. It's the kind of thing that some people, like Harry Kane's a star, Ronaldo's a star, and they've got that thing attached to them, but Torres doesn't yet.
He also kind of exists outside the Clásico bubble as well, and he sort of he comes from, I mean, Valencia are a really big club, but at the same time, it's quite sort of, he's not where you would point your kind of defensive resources if you're playing against them.
He shares the name of a legend. I know that's slightly less important than all the things that you said before, but it's difficult to eclipse the name of a legend.
Maybe. And this might be also where, that sort of non-specific position becomes a strength. I have no idea from a coaching perspective, but if a player doesn't have a kind of a clear purpose or a clear role, it's just kind of utility attacking player on the right side. Mm. Must be very difficult to defend against. Yeah. I'm guessing. I have absolutely no idea. It just seems like it might be.
Especially with rotations, because the defenders aren't sure exactly who's going to, they're going to be up against. And then you forget which way you need to put them. And well, if he's there, where's the other guy? And everything you just have to second guess. If you're defending zonally, which most people would be in a sort of situation, of course, if you're against someone running at you, you always are. You're just trying to mark the space. Yeah, it's going to be really difficult to deal with. Very useful for a manager as well. It means he's always going to be in squads. It's that other cliche that if you don't have a nailed down position, where do you end up playing? And you end up being a utility player rather than a forward. It could just be his age. You don't really think of him as a Man City, like an important Man City player. No. He's played some big games for them.
Yeah.
And done very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another player that you mentioned during the game, and has been mentioned here in the chat by Jake99, who says, Pedri is the player English fans think Foden is.
Foden's one of the best young players in the entire world. I think he might even...
Unfair to Foden, but nice for Pedri.
I love Pedri. If you've not seen Pedri yet, how do you explain him? He's kind of like he plays an eight for Spain on the left side of the midfield three. Does the same thing for Barcelona. But he plays a little bit like the Iniesta role used to, like advance. So he'd be the advanced playmaker, basically. He can play off the left wing and come onto his right foot. I think he can play in the right as well, actually. He can play as a 10. He's just a really very talented footballer. Incredible technique, great vision. There was a pass he played. There was a reverse ball into Jordi Alba that set up an almost goal that he pinged across 6-yard box.
That was very Iniesta.
That is stunning. That's the kind of thing you cannot teach that. You can't coach that into someone. That's something he just sees the space where the players are going to go, and he probably even knew he was making that run before he turned. I think he takes it on the half turn and then just plays it. So it's a reverse pass, cuts him open. That's the kind of player that Spain need to be able to play the possession football that they want to, because you can mix up your tempo. He can fire these balls in. He's fantastic. But Foden is properly next level. Like, he is in the top tier, I would say.
I like that tier. That's my favourite tier.
Me too.
Spain-Croatia, lots of nice players in that game, wouldn't there be?
Obviously Modric, I mean, he ran the game for Croatia against Scotland, and I can't remember much of what he did in other games, but I assume he probably did the same thing. Mm. And now I'm just thinking about that game again.
in which case, Seb, what do you think about that one coming up?
I don't know what's the true Spain yet. I feel as if Spain today were given a little bit of a leg up by Martin Dubravka, which, by the way, on that, I have a little bit of sympathy for him. I mean, because it's still a terrible mistake, don't get me wrong, but he's underneath his own crossbar, spinning ball. It's harder to do that than it looks. And it doesn't excuse what happened. Clearly he should push it over and out for a corner.
You'd prefer it if he punched someone in the face, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
what you want.
As long as he got a little bit of the ball first.
Yeah.
And then the ball went out and yeah. That's okay. Yeah.
That's who he is now.
I also, like I met someone who I went to school with a really long time ago, and it'd been about 10 between leaving and me seeing him again. And when he was at school, he made a terrible goalkeeping error, which about 300 people, which is a lot in school terms, mm-hmm. had seen him do. Like he, mm-hmm. there was a sort of a looping cross that came in, and he thought it was going over the bar. And so he kind of comes running out towards the edge of a 6-yard box, leaves it in that kind of slightly elaborate demonstrative way that goalkeepers do, the kind of, and it just dropped painfully over the line. Didn't even hit the net. It just dropped about a foot over the line, just bounced there. And it was completely humiliating for him. And I saw him and we got to talking about, we were playing like old boys football. And he brought it up. It'd been about a decade. And it was still a really raw memory for him. And so, and that's at schoolboy level. Who cares? It doesn't matter. It's just amateur, you know, awful football. Can you imagine that happening to you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there going to be a day in Martin Dubravka's life where he doesn't think about that? It won't be a painful memory forever, but every time you that's going to be him. That's part of his identity. I feel so sorry for people that happens to.
I think he might get saved by having let in another four after that. So that
yeah,
sort
but the second one was kind of his fault too, JJ, as well. And it's like, it's got to be the most horrible feeling to know that you, first of all, you open the floodgates on your own team, and ultimately goal difference kind of costs Slovakia of their place in the next round. But also that you've become associated with something which lives forever on YouTube. It's awful. I just want to give him a hug after that happened.
But then another good benefit to it, I'll try and balance this out. I'll play this game, Joe.
Mm.
When
a balancing game.
There's so many different videos of all these. I mean, that Hawaiian goalkeeper that was doing the rounds.
Oh, my goodness.
That's another example of a video that everyone's seen.
No.
I'll disappear. There's heaps of these. There's so many videos now that they all tend to turn into one. They're everywhere, and they're on your WhatsApp for about a day and a half, and then they're gone away, and then one of your uncles will send you it again about up 2 months later when they get it for the first time.
That good balancing.
That's it. And also Slovakia fell apart, and I think I mean, I can't speak for the nation of Slovakia. Far be it from me to do that.
Have a go.
I think they'll remember their whole team collapsing in that way, that horrible way that you can't really prevent, and you can see it happen in front of you. You can't stop it. The players were there. They just couldn't stop it happening.
Yeah.
Dubravka's he puts it in his own net, which made it difficult because the thing, once Spain then have the lead, it means the Slovakia have to open up to come into them. And that's when you start getting the space occasionally that lets Spain in. So it's a mistake that kind of opens it up. But it's, I think the nation of Slovakia should not hold Dubravka to that because the whole team really.
That Haitian goalkeeper, I cringed so hard, like I felt like maybe my spine would snap. It was just excruciating to watch. It was, I can't even, we can make a defense for Martin Dubravka and you can say, well, it's quite hard, the ball's spinning and there's a bit of sunshine in his eyes. And I still can't understand what the Haitian goalkeeper was trying to do. I haven't heard a sort of a rational explanation for how that could happen. It's just, I feel so sorry for him. It's awful.
Haven't seen it, so don't know what's happening.
Hey, let's talk about when you might see it. So
because
this will be a good plug. You know, because maybe after when we go to the Old Red Lion Theatre Pub in Islington for our sort of final pod after.
Don't
party.
Tell them where I'm gonna be.
No, well, you know, the door's locked there.
I'm the
there was a guy that turned up this morning outside and sort of wanted me to go for breakfast with him. So you're gonna be in on this.
Oh my god, are you serious?
No, he just took a picture.
He was joking.
That guy's I've met that guy, he's a nice guy. He came to the TIFO quiz.
That's good.
He did though. Yeah. Send a picture to me on Twitter of him outside the place where I was sleeping, asking me if I wanted
the
to go.
Public house you were living above, on the main road.
He seems like a very nice guy.
In the capital city of the country.
A new friend.
Country.
New friend.
Anyway.
A break.
The Old Red Lion, the best place to watch, this isn't an ad, the best place to watch football in London. If you go there, go and ask for Uncle Damien. He'll tell you stories about Harlow, Essex in the 60s and how he remembers the World Cup final. There was no one on the streets, says Uncle Damien. Everyone was watching the big game. Go and talk to him. It's more fun than it sounds. And there's tellies everywhere for the football and in the garden. Come on. Doesn't get better
TVs
than a telly in the garden.
The Old Red Lion are brilliant.
Two big screens.
Really
there's a theatre that you can book out to watch big football.
There's a great dog.
Great Olo. Dog. Don't feed the dog. Don't feed Uncle Damien. Definitely don't feed Uncle Damien because you know, that man. Ooh. Right. Sweden are through 3-2. Sweden 3-2 Poland. The notes say, did we watch this? No. But we saw some of the goals. It was on in the background. We were watching the other game. Dejan Kulusevski, nice assist. Emil Forsberg, a couple of nice goals. Lovely, lovely stuff. But the main thing we wanted to say here is that they're going to play Ukraine.
Yes, they
sounds
are.
Like the most fun game of the round of 16.
Reprieve from Ukraine. So also, and let's be fair, Sweden are, they're a veteran tournament side. They're always a bit stubborn. They always manage to kind of progress and have decent results. There is no need for
they know how it works.
They do. No need for a Ukrainian inferiority complex. So let's see the better side of Ukraine this time, I think, because they were pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
In the group stage. So
this is an opportunity. They've been given an opportunity.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll see a little bit more of Malinowski, who is one of my favorite players at the tournament. And Yaremchuk.
There we
That's
go.
Another player. That's not like a new phrase I've picked up.
No, I know.
I was hoping it was a phrase. But, yeah.
I'm with you.
Yaremchuk.
We've been running for a long time now, I think. I think it's because we messed up the intro so many times.
Yeah.
It was a real slow burn to get into this one. But there we go. Very exciting. We now know that the fixtures, the round of 16 are very exciting.
Ukraine, says the chat.
England, Germany, Portugal, Belgium. You can't ask for more than that this early in the knockout stages. That's top dog, isn't it? That is top dog as far as round of 16 fixtures go. I'm excited to come back here on Saturday. I don't know which game the first one is, but it's going to be fun.
I think the first one is Wales-Denmark, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be
gonna
fun
be a great
too.
Game, two really evenly matched teams. I'm excited. Loads of Jeopardy.
It's all Jeopardy from here on out.
Are we doing predictions tonight? Are we going to delay that?
No, let's not do predictions. We'll do those privately. Before we record the next game's worth. But I will tell you now, points are bad. And I have many points. I earned many points. Not as many as Seb though. Seb earned many points today. You're still in front of me in the points are bad game. I'll give you that. But there were 8 points separated us yesterday, and only 3 separate us now.
Really, I gained 5 today. Yeah.
Do you know why?
Was it?
Because my 2-2 wasn't so stupid after all, was it?
Bang on.
It really
bang
wasn't.
On.
2-2. I know what I'm talking about. Anyway, JJ, you had a bad day.
Yeah.
You did have a bad day.
I had a bad day.
Alex had a pretty good day.
Did he?
He got a correct score as well. I think he predicted something accurately. I can't remember which one it was. It might have been one of the games that happened. Who knows? But Alex is currently leading on 68 points. JJ, second place, 73. You've got 5 points to make up now. There's plenty of games left. Plenty of games left to do that in. And Alex has definitely got a slip up in him. So we'll wait and pray for that. JJ, 73. 79, Seb. You've widened the gap quite dramatically to JJ there. Six points. And of course, 11 behind Alex there. He'll be loving that, rubbing his hands at home, giggling and cackling like he does.
Points are so bad.
And points are very, very bad for me because I've got 82. but what can you do? There were many games today. And it was difficult to know what was going to happen because no one does. No one does. Anyway, that's the end of today's episode. What a big day. Final day of the group stages. Woo, woo! Couple of days off for us now. It's going to be real nice. And going to head to the old Red Lion, have a drink. And celebrate, celebrate...
Not being here.
Yeah, not being here for a couple of days. Real fun. JJ Ball the Bullet, thank you to you.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, man. Seb Stafford Bloor, thanking you also.
Thank you, Joe Devine.
Philippe Fenner, TIFO illustrator extraordinaire in the background, thanks for joining us this evening, and your beloved France did not lose. Well done. There we go. And of course, thanks as usual to our crack team, in the production wing of Don and Craig. And there's Don's little hands there making a violent gesture. Still lovely, though. There they go. All right. To all of the people watching, thanks for being with us during the group stages. It's been a pleasure to broadcast to all of you. Absolutely.
Everyone's been very nice.
Yeah, very nice. Very few comments have needed removing or moderating. So that's lovely, isn't it? Especially because the internet's such a horrible place a lot of the time. But thanks to all the TIFOs, and we'll be back not tomorrow, not the next day, but on Saturday to start the round of 16 and to give you all the coverage that you deserve. It's coming home.